This is the Hidden Figures Omnibus. Over the Lent term, students put together podcasts highlighting various non-white people throughout history, from their achievements to their impact on the world. To start us off, Will and Rory researched a West Indian cricketer whose astonishing feats in the sport were accompanied by a lifetime of discrimination.
Hello, and welcome to this Jukebox podcast, where today we aim to uncover and reveal a non-white hidden figure that we feel has had a monumentous impact on society in their lifetime. Join me, Will Ayton, and my co-host Rory Yeldon, as today we specifically look at the cricketing icon Michael Holden, who we both believe has not received as much recognition as he truly deserves for his influential work in the field of sport. Rory, would you like to take the time to introduce him? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Will. It's a pleasure to be here. So, Michael Holding is a Jamaican cricket commentator for Sky Sports and a former cricketer who played for the West Indies cricket team. One of the best fast bowlers ever to play Test cricket, he was nicknamed the Whispering Death due to his silent, light-footed run-up to the bowling crease. His bowling was smooth and extremely fast, and he used his height of 6'3" to generate large amounts of bounce and zip off the pitch. He was part of the fearsome West Indian pace battery, including the late Malcolm Marshall, that devastated batting lineups throughout the world in the 70s and early 80s. Early in his Test career, in 1976, Holding broke the record for the best bowling figures in a Test match by a West Indian bowler, 14 wickets for 149 runs. The record still stands. During his first class cricket career, Holding played for Jamaica, Canterbury, Derbyshire, Lancashire and Tasmania.
Recently though, and much more importantly, his attention turned to addressing the very important matter of the Black Lives Matter movement, in which he delivered an empowering speech on his views and stand against racism in the return to Test cricket in the summer of 2020. It was particularly poignant due to his true emotional connection, where he spoke from his heart and unscripted, and broke down to tears whilst making his speech. He uncovered some very personal and telling stories which we will delve into whilst discussing our thoughts on this matter. So first of all, I'd like to start by asking Rory, what struck you about Michael Holding's stand in his speech?
That's a very interesting question, Will. I'd have to say it's his idea on how we should update schooling. I think it's a great idea and it's not spoken about enough. I think to teach the younger children the issue of racism is very important, and it definitely should not be tolerated at this moment in time. Michael uses a very candid example of this, which really opened my eyes to this problem, saying that everyone knows Thomas Edison, the man who invented the light bulb, for his work, but this only was made with a paper filament, which could only work for several hours and wasn't very efficient. However, it was a man named Lewis Howard Latimer, who was black, who created a copper filament that enabled a light to burn for much longer and allow the lights on our streets to be so good. He argued that no one has ever taught history like this, and this is very true, I feel, and how two sides of the story have been hidden from us for centuries. To me, this is a prime example of how black lives are undervalued and how white men and women have been given privileges for so many years. Following up from this, Will, one of the things Michael delves into is the idea that privilege is still present. Do you think this is true? And if so, how should it be addressed?
Thanks, Rory. In our current society, I feel like we constantly brush this idea under the carpet. And to me, this is just totally unacceptable. We all know that history is written by the conqueror, not the conquered. And until we rewrite our history books and we learn about both sides of the story, in my opinion, white supremacy and racism will have the possibility of continuing to thrive, which is just not what our modern day society should be like.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. The other side of the story is key, and everyone's equal in this world. Everyone's a human, and until we learn that other chapter, other side of the story, we're just allowing racism to to come about.
So, Rory, were there any instances in Michael's speech which highlighted the stigma of black victimisation that you think is truly unacceptable?
Yeah, he mentioned a few which really struck a chord with me, I'd say. So one of his experiences was he was in Leicester Square with his Portuguese wife, who's white, and he waved his hand to get a taxi because they just had a meal, and the taxi coming towards him had his light on, signalling he was ready to take a passenger. But as soon as he saw the taxi driver, as soon as he saw Michael was black, he turned off his light. Then following this, a Caribbean man from the other side of the road who knew Michael shouted across saying, "You need to put her in front," suggesting that the white woman has to go in front of him. I think this is outrageous, to be honest, and sort of shows that it's happening in everyday life, even if you don't think it is. Taxi drivers in London, across the UK, small acts like this are just so bad, and I feel for those people who have to live through that. Another example was during Michael's time playing in the West Indian team in the 80s, where he was in a hotel and he was in an elevator going up, and it stopped on a floor and a white Australian man was outside. The elevator was reasonably full, but it wasn't at full capacity. But the white man didn't enter and he decided to walk instead. Michael suggests that this it could be made because he could have been intimidated, but this is still a racist remark, something like this can happen to anyone.
And just following on from that, Michael, for many years, through his childhood into his teens, just laughed off all his matters and experiences with racism, but ever since recently, the Black Lives Matter movement, and especially in sport nowadays, we see people taking the knee before games to really enact change. And he believes that he can't keep laughing it off, and definitely the time is right to not laugh it off and really drive the change that we need in society. Because at this moment in time,
The longer you laugh it off, the worse it will get, and the more people think that it's all right, which is definitely not the case. Yeah. So, final question here, Will. Is there anything that can be done, and if so, what is that?
I think there's a huge possibility of change, actually. And only recently, I was reading an article. I can't remember the company actually, but The company started to pledge money towards this matter and their stand against racism. In fact, the corporation donated £30 million towards a foundation.
Yeah, I think it was Sky Sports, Will.
Oh, yeah. Was it? Actually, fine. And we need more big corporations like this to really drive the change. Yes, it will be an enormous effort. But we further to this, we need to see, I believe, black people making big decisions, black politicians, black MPs,
CEOs, all of that, yeah.
CFOs.
Definitely.
And I just hope the train will keep moving, and that future generations will see this equality. Because I don't think we can expect change overnight. We have to start somewhere, and I think this somewhere has really started to take a leapfrog.
I think it started, really, because like Michael said in his, he gave two examples, actually. One of them was that he saw lots of white people in the protest, which is a big plus, and I think that it shows that people do understand what's wrong, even if it might not affect them individually. I think people do understand that what other people are doing may be completely wrong. And then another example he gave was in the US, where a white man posted on social media some racist remarks, and it was immediately banned from the website, which is a good thing. And later on, the son of the same man posted saying how sorry he was that his father had done that. But he also said that he was glad it happened, so that his father had learned a lesson, because he was trying to tell him for years that it's not on and it can't happen. So it gave him the opportunity to sit down with his father and tell him that he needs to buck up his ideas and stop what he's been saying.
So I think Michael also delved into this idea that racism at times is unconscious, and stories like that at times could be an unconscious thought that just seeps into someone's brain. And he put this down to the fact that it's not being taught, like we've mentioned before, and that at this moment in time, thoughts like this have become almost automatic. And we've come to learn through education that these automatic thoughts just aren't correct and are not part of a moral compass. And I think to change these thoughts, it just has to start from educating, especially.
Yeah, definitely from a teaching's perspective, that's key.
I'd just like to end, because I think we've covered all we've wanted to, by thanking you, Rory, for joining me today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Will. I think it's great to speak about this, and I think it's what's needed for lots of people to understand what is wrong at the moment. And yeah, carry on like this, and hopefully change will come soon, yeah.
Thanks.
Will and Rory were discussing the influence of Michael Holding. We'll hear about another sportsman next from Lucas, one whose prowess across athletics made him a figurehead for Black America against the backdrop of the strengthening Nazi regime.
Hi guys, I'm Lucas, and today I'll be discussing the very influential track and field star Jesse Owens. Jesse Owens was a track athlete back in the 1930s. He was born on September 12, 1913 in Alabama and died on March 31, 1980. He was also a four-time gold medalist at the 1936 Olympic Games. He specialised in sprinting and the long jump. He was also known as the best athlete ever in track and field history. In fact, he was such a good athlete that he set three world records at one event, which was in Michigan. This also took place in under 1 hour. This has never been done by anyone else ever, and it was an insane feat. It was an insane achievement that was known as one of the greatest achievements ever in sports. His four gold medals at the 1936 Olympics were 100 metres, long jump, 200 metres and the relay. Even after all these achievements and being the most successful man at the Olympics, he still wasn't invited to shake hands with the president because of the simple fact that he was black. And back then, if you were black, you would have not have been respected. ESPN had ranked him sixth best athlete of North American history and the best athlete ever in his sport. In 1999, he was also put on the BBC's shortlist of the century. His father was a farmer and his grandfather was a slave. When he was 9, he moved to Ohio for better opportunities. It was also because he was part of the Great Migration, which was well over 1.5 million African Americans that moved to the north of America for jobs and a better life, as there would be less segregation and racism towards them. During his early years, when he had moved to Ohio and had just started going to school there, that was when he discovered his passion for running. He first started track running during high school, where his track coach realized he had a great potential. After high school, he then went to Ohio State University, where his track and field really started to take off, winning many championships and events throughout his university life. Although he was a star of university in track and field, he still had to stay off the campus with the other African-American students, and therefore showing that segregation was still occurring. When he was invited to the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, Germany, people were telling him not to go because it was very dangerous and ruled by the Nazis at the time. But he said that he was not going to pull out of the event and go home, but instead to beat everyone there and to beat discrimination and to show the Nazis that he was much better than them. In conclusion, in my opinion, I think that Jesse... Owens is one of the most inspirational people that I have discussed, and I believe that he was a true example of what sport was about. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Lucas was discussing the life and times of Jesse Owens. Finally, we'll cover not just a person, but a movement, as Matilda delves into the African-American influences on tap dancing.
Bend those legs out there. Bend them. That's it, baby. Bend them.
All right, I'll bend them. Bend them.
Hello! As you may have gathered from that intro, today I'm going to be talking about tap dance. And if you don't know anything about tap, please don't be scared away or immediately uninterested, because the other theme of this podcast is hidden figures. So black people in throughout history who have gone unrecognized and unrepresented and have been left out of the story. And I think that tap is an excellent medium through which to see how black people have been hidden in the story of tap and what we see, because, well, I'm a dancer, I do tap, I have for a few years now, I love it, it's amazing. But for most of you listening, you probably haven't and probably don't have that many experiences with it. But when I was coming to think about what I would talk about today, I considered what is most people's experience with tap, and if you think to your own, maybe you've seen it in a musical, or particularly if not in real life, you might have seen it in a Hollywood, a Golden Age musical, like Singing in the Rain. You might be familiar with Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly, the kind of faces of tap that we still recognise today, even if it's not necessarily in its heyday anymore. But actually, what is the common conception today kind of misses out a really interesting story of how it came to be that is very linked to the story of African Americans, a story very much rooted in slavery and the changing place of African Americans in American society. So that's kind of what I want to touch on today, and I hope that you're interested to come along with me. Before I start, I just wanted to give you some recommendations of books. I love books, so I'm going to recommend books that I really love from black authors writing in relation to race. And I just encourage you generally to engage with black creators, writers, media, films, everything, and yeah, make sure that your engagement with the world is diverse in general. But so from me, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, she's well known, but she's really talented. I've read Purple Hibiscus by her, which is like amazing. She's written fiction, non-fiction, she's great, love her. Claudia Rankine, I've also done an episode, I've done a podcast on her actually as well, which you can go listen to if you like. It's an amazing book. It's called Citizen. It's part of a series, so you can read around that. But it's poetry, it's prose, it's an amazing work. And yeah, those are just two that I really recommend. But yeah, like, go read things. And also, a lot of these people I'm going to mention, I can't show you the videos due to the medium that I'm presenting this in. But I will be playing some clips. And I really highly recommend you to go look on YouTube, find clips of some of the people I'm going to mention, because they're honestly, like, so talented. It's crazy. The origins of tap really start with slavery in America. What you get is African people who've been enslaved and taken and are now working, at least some people working on plantations in Southern America, picking cotton, etc., working on plantations. And so Christianity, which is obviously the dominant religion amongst white Europeans who are living in America and who are the plantation owners and the slave owners. They're all Christians and they really frown on dancing because they're like all uptight and whatever. And also drums are banned for slaves because in order to prevent rebellion, supposedly. And so, but obviously people still want to dance. They still have fun. They still want to express themselves. And so we get this predecessor of tap, which is just looking for a style of dancing that doesn't look like dancing, at least not to a white European, right? Because if you think about what the popular dance styles would have been, it's very much ballroom, very much ballet, codified styles that are very distinct from tap, if you imagine what that is. So it's about feet movement, it's about being grounded, and also they're looking for something to create percussion. So it's kind of stamping, kind of a very different individual style to fit these requirements of what they need dancing to be. And you also get in here in these origins, kind of it touches on the core of what tap is and what it symbolizes still today, because it's very much like a communal dance, and a lot of about tap is about teachers teaching to someone and passing that around, passing around different rhythms, passing around different moves. And so it's very much a form connected with self-expression, with connecting with people, with fun, and about like rhythm and heartbeat. And so you get that right from the very beginning, which is pretty awesome. Around this time, you've also got minstrel groups. So these are white performers who will present caricatures of slaves on plantations and kind of mock them and do blackface and they're like supposed to be entertaining and do these kind of comedic supposedly performances, and they'd go traveling around. And here we see there's a man called Master Yuba, whose name was Master Yuba, but his name was William Henry Lane. And he was the only black person to tour with a white minstrel group. And he was a tapper in the early days of that, kind of creating the meaning of what it is. But he was a really interesting figure because he's the only black person to be touring with a white minstrel group. And another interesting thing about these minstrel group is that one of the characters that they would take on was called Jim Crow. And if you don't know, that's the name for the segregation laws in America. So that's actually a really interesting connection that we get in the roots of and the periphery of tap. We get this origin of this very divisive, very significant moment later in American history. So after slavery is abolished, you get a lot of freed slaves living in this place called Five Points in NYC, which is now it's now Chinatown. If you've ever been, I haven't been to NYC, but it's Chinatown now. But back then, it was really a cultural melting pot of people of different cultures and different countries, and a lot of freed slaves, as I was saying. And here, this is relevant in what tap is, because you get this intersection of the dances that the freed slaves now have from slavery that we discussed just a minute ago, and you get it crossing with Irish jigging and British clogging, which are styles that have similarities. If you're familiar with Irish dancing, it's all in the feet. It's all about like it's kind of similar to tap. It's kind of about stomping and clomping and stuff. And British clogging, which isn't really that much around as far as I know, but it's actually a pretty interesting style that came about when people started wearing clogs on their feet, and obviously they're quite loud, so people would use them to stamp about and things. So you get all these styles intersecting and all these people coexisting. So this is kind of pushing tap forward a bit more into its different influences. So tap starts to peak around the 20s and 30s, and I don't think I can really overstate like how important it was at the time. If you were an actor, you had to be a good tap dancer. Like, people would say you have to dance, but what they meant was like, you have to tap dance, and you have to tap dance very, very well. And 30s we get Great Depression, and so when people were going to see the pictures, going to see movies, they were looking for form of escapism, really, and films were just kind of supposed to be fun and distracting and just like be a really good time. So we've got a lot of these Golden Age musicals, like I was saying, and a lot of tap dancing. And here is where we can really point out some of the really interesting black figures of tap. So, for example, we've got the Nicholas brothers, who their parents were musicians. They were born in and around the clubs of the time, and they're brothers, and they did these incredible, really acrobatic, really athletic, like, these routines that were like about them jumping to the splits and doing all these great stunts. And I think it's from Stormy Weather, this clip, and so I'll just play you guys a bit of the sound, but I'm really, go watch this clip, because they're amazing, they're so bouncy, but yeah, listen to this. Stormy Weather from 1943, and you have to watch this video, because they're just like jumping and doing these amazing rhythms and really like strong technical work, and they were more or less self-taught. Like, they just kind of picked it up from being around the clubs and learning from around them, but they were really one of the well-known acts of the time. And so I saw a documentary with one of them talking. Their names were Fayard and Harold, and I believe it was Harold talking about an experience that they had in one of the clubs once they were really like well known and they were in all the pictures and things. And so they would be performing in the clubs, but all the clubs were segregated, and so black performers could perform. There was just no way that they would be allowed onto the club floor to interact with the white patrons. But the Nicholas brothers were at such a stage that they were allowed to sometimes have drinks and be treated as patrons and to integrate into the club somewhat. So here we see again this theme where tap is telling us how it's just a vehicle to see changing dispositions, because obviously we've got this terrible segregation, but at the same time we're seeing how people are changing and getting a bit more accepting. Another figure from this time is a man called Bill Bojangles Robinson, and he is another amazing dancer, and the very interesting thing about him was that he danced alongside Shirley Temple. And I've actually talked with a few people about Shirley Temple and realized that people don't know who she is. She was a child. I remember describing her entirely to someone, and then I forgot to mention that she was like 4 at the time. She was this child star, and she was absolutely massive. She was so famous. She was like the most well-known person, like, in film at the time. She was a beloved, she was the nation's sweetheart, blah, blah, blah. Like, she was this 5-year-old who, whenever a film came out with her, dance school enrollment went up. You would know that it was a box office hit. Like, Shirley Temple movies were the thing of the time. And so, Bill Bojangles Robinson, he actually danced alongside Shirley in some of her movies. And why this is so groundbreaking in a way is that black performers were allowed to be in movies, but usually they would be performers within the narrative of the film. They're not characters, they're just people performing. And so you get that perception of segregation. And what was really interesting was that sometimes even the black performers would be put in interludes in the film, which sometimes would be cut out, especially for Southern audiences, so that they would be more palatable and to prevent from causing outrage, really, which is pretty crazy. He is somewhat infantilized in the view of the story, but he's still there. He's dancing, holding hands with this little white girl as part of the story. It's really a step forward in the presentation of how black people were presented in movies of that day, and it's far from perfect. As I said, his character's kind of infantilized. He's not like a real character within the story, but it's a totally different presentation that is something that is totally unique to him. So let me just play you a little clip of him dancing here for you with Shirley Temple.
I went to the market for to get some beef, and the beef's on top, and I couldn't get enough. I paid $5 for a great big hog, and the hog's so fat, and I couldn't get back.
Around this time, finally, I just wanted to mention also this man, John W. Bubbles. His name was William Sublette, and he was around in the 1930s as well, and he's known as the father of rhythm tap. So he's this great figure who was really involved in vaudeville and a great tapper as well. So let me just play you a little clip of that. Moving on, after the 30s, tap is kind of starting to die out. We get Second World War, and tap isn't so much in the public conscious in the same way that it was around the 30s. It never is. I mean, so far. Maybe we'll get a resurgence in the 2030s or something. But as of yet, tap has never reached the heights that it did then, as far as I understand it. So I wanted to cover briefly what's going on in tap today, and just to touch on one figure, his name is Savion Glover. He's an American, he's a modern tap dancer with like this unique style. It's called hitting. He's kind of trying to renew this interest in tap. He describes it as free form, hardcore. He's got his own school in Newark, and He is another embodiment of the principles of tap to me. There's this quote here that he teaches an approach to the dance that is holistic, honest, and true to what his students are. That he doesn't want to codify it. He doesn't want to make it strict. He does dance education versus dance class. And so I think we can see there how the spirit of tap and what it means has maintained itself throughout this whole process of it. And yeah, that's just really amazing to see. So yeah, that's kind of my overview of tap dance in America, particularly relating to black people, to African Americans. And I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it was somewhat educational. If you want to watch these tappers, as I really highly recommend you do. So the people I mentioned today were John W. Bubbles, Bilbo Jangles Robinson, and the Nicholas Brothers. You can also look at Savion Glover, a man called Will Gaines, who I'm going to leave you with now. Will Gaines, just to mention quickly, he was more involved in the UK tap and jazz scene, and so he wasn't really relevant when I was talking about America, but he was a black dancer in the UK involved in those scenes, and he worked with Duke Ellington and Billie Holiday and was overall amazing. So if you want to just search any of those dancers into YouTube, you can watch movies like Stormy Weather or The Little Colonel or Captain January. there's a whole bunch of things, and there are some documentaries out there that are really interesting if you just look around on YouTube, just up there for free, and interviews with some of these dancers. So yeah, go have a look if you're interested. Don't if you're not. Come do tap at Welly if you like. But yeah, thank you so much for listening. And with that, I'll leave you with Will Gaines. Goodbye.
Who was Royce Edward Gaines? Who was he? Where did he come from? The hospital flooded. There was no record of me being born. My name is Willie Gaines. I come from Detroit. I don't know what that is, but whatever it is, it was something that I thought I was doing with my feet. I tap dance and I tap dance and I tap dance and the bump and the rap a tap a tap a tap. New York says you're going to England. So I packed my bag, my hat, out the door, into the taxi, straight to the airport.
Matilda was discussing the African-American influence on tap dancing. We hope you've enjoyed this Hidden Figures omnibus, and if you want to find more podcasts, then you can visit the Dukebox website at dukeboxradio.com.